Page 94, the Private Eye podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Page 94. My name is Andrew Hunter-Murray, and this edition we'll discuss the BBC, first of all. It is in the middle of another enormous reorganisation, so we're going to talk about what that means for the journalists who actually work there. We're also going to have a look at Public Health England, the agency which has just been axed by the government, and we'll find out exactly what that means for the public health of England, apart from anything else. Finally, we're going to be talking to the magazine's editor, Ian Hislop, about the trials and the tribulations and the occasional joys of producing a magazine in a state of lockdown when people not only aren't allowed to leave home to buy a magazine at a newsstand, they're also not allowed to leave home to work on a magazine. That's coming up later. But first, coronavirus, again. One of the recent stories about the ongoing crisis is the government's announcement that it's going to axe its health agency, Public Health England. And Public Health England is going to be replaced by a new agency called the National Institute for Health Protection. This is all a bit confusing for anyone who doesn't work in the field of public health, and in fact it's quite confusing for those who do. I spoke to Phil Hammond, Private Eye's medical correspondent, and started off by asking him what Public Health England actually was. Here's Phil.
I think one of the problems is nobody was quite sure. If you look on its website, which is interestingly hosted by the government, it's clearly an agency of the Department of Health and Social Care under control of the Health Secretary, which is Matt Hancock. And it talks a good game. It says its first duty is to protect the health of the public, and it is available 365 days a year, 24 hours a day to do that.
Okay, so, but it's not a public-facing thing in the sense that no one goes to Public Health England. It's an agency to advise on public health?
Exactly. It was a quango set up in the 2012 Health and Social Care Act, where most of the responsibility for public health, which previously lay within the NHS, on the front line was given to local authorities and then further outsourced to some private companies. And then at the top, it was taken out into this separate quango, which was out of the control of the NHS, but under the remit of the Department of Health. The idea apparently was that Andrew Lansley, who was the architect of these disastrous reforms, wanted a clear line of sight. And he wanted to pass the buck for all the day-to-day scandals of the NHS to a commissioning board, which became NHS England, so he wouldn't be bothered by terrible scandals on the front line. And I think he saw himself actually as the Secretary of State for Public Health. So he wanted to be floating along the top and have this agency just underneath him, and he would take over public health, and the day-to-day running of health services would be the NHS. The fatal flaw in that is that public health is really complicated, and when a disaster happens, it requires everything to be coordinated. You need local authorities, you need NHS frontline care, you need the Department of Health, you need the Chief Medical Officer, you need the Secretary of State for Health. And they've created a huge collusion of anonymity, so nobody's quite sure who is responsible for what. So when you ask me, what does Public Health England do, I'm not even sure they know. They're now furiously saying we were never supposed to be in charge of mass testing for COVID. Well, they've had 7 years of pandemic planning. So if between them, Public Health England, the NHS and the Department of Health and Social Care can't even decide the most important response in an emergency, it suggests that nobody's quite sure what anybody's doing.
And the other thing is that it is independent from the Department of Health and Social Care, kind of.
I don't quite buy that.
Right.
If you look in its charter, Section 4, it says it's clearly accountable to the Health Secretary. So it's not as independent as it seems to be. And the very fact that it doesn't even have its own website, it's hosted within the Department of Health and Social Care, actually says operationally it doesn't have nearly as much independence as you think.
Because there are public health agencies in other countries, aren't there? So there's one you refer to in your story in this week's magazine, the Robert Koch Institute in Germany.
Yes.
And that, you say, is a little more independent, and it's certainly more scientifically guided than Public Health England is.
Well, it also has the advantage of stability. So Matt Hancock is furiously saying, I want to model my new agency on the German example. But the German example has been going for 125 years.
Right.
So it has stability, and it has very close links with 370 regional public health offices. So it clearly has a structure that allows it to respond quickly in a pandemic. So we got rid of our regional health public health offices. We devolved everything to the front line. We then cut funding by about 40% since 2012. And what's interesting is that everybody said at the time that this splintering up of services would be hopeless in a pandemic, and so it has proven to be. So that I'm not sure what Matt Hancock's new agency will achieve, but they don't ever seem to have a plan. They react to a crisis, so they're always reacting to crises, but they don't seem to have coordinated long-term joined-up plans.
Yeah, the new agency is going to combine Public Health England with other agencies, the Joint Biosecurity Centre. It seems like another reorganisation.
Well, it's taking the infection control bit out of Public Health England. We don't know what happens to all the other bits of Public Health England. We know that health is largely environmental and economically determined. So income inequality leads to health inequality. So somebody needs to be looking at the role of poverty and poor diet and obesity and air pollution and antimicrobial resistance. There are dozens of other things that are crucial to public health that aren't involved in Matt Hancock's new body. He's just looking at pandemic control. And in that sense, you could say it makes sense to his biosecurity centre and the test and trace centre and the public health protection elements of PHE. It makes sense to put them into one body. But the trouble is he's almost outsourced it into a parallel universe. Most of the testing is being done by the private sector. Because Public Health England is separate from local authorities and the NHS, there's been a lot of criticism about not sharing data. But there are huge data protection laws now. So if you create a separate body, then it's really hard to share data that might identify individuals about infections that they've had. So by creating all these separate bodies, and the new agency is again outside everything else, I don't see how it's going to solve the problem of a service that isn't joined up.
We're left effectively with a situation similar to the one we had before, but other bits are being left out this time round. Is that what we're saying?
Yes. Yeah, so I don't know yet. I mean, I know public health consultants who've had meetings with Dido Harding online and Michael Brody, who's their interim chair and chief executive, neither of whom are public health experts. Obviously, Dido Harding has a history in retail and TalkTalk. And Michael Brody is a manager and accountant who's actually worked at Public Health England, but he's not a public health expert. I think what's interesting is that when he announced his new body, there were very few press there and very few public health experts, but lots of private companies. So I think Matt Hancock sees this as his own little vanity project, parallel universe plaything, but also a chance to feather the nests of all his mates in outsourcing. So all the outsourcing of testing is being given to private companies. But they've been shown they're absolutely piss poor at doing the contact tracing bit.
Yes.
So testing is fine. You can throw tests at everyone, but they're quite complex to understand. If, you know, we know at the moment that deaths and admission rates to hospitals are down, but positive cases are up. Is that because we're doing more testing? Is it because we're picking up more young, healthy people who aren't much affected by COVID? I mean, there are all sorts of reasons we could be doing this. And if you just do the tests and you don't do the difficult contact trace support advice bit, then you create probably more problems than you solve.
It sounds like a complete mess, to be honest with you. And that's the impression I definitely got from reading your column this week. Is that fair?
It is. I think the thing that frustrates me is that we saw it coming. I mean, every public health expert worth his or her salt flagged this in 2012. As you know, my one and only appearance on BBC's Question Time was to tell Andrew Lansley that his plan would just splinter things up and people would fall through the cracks. So even I spotted it. In 2012. But I think the public health experts nailed it. They said very clearly this will not work in a pandemic. So to suddenly blame the quango you created seems pretty unfair. And it's got some brilliant staff. I mean, you know, you need your public health experts. It's not their fault they were put in a splintered system that doesn't work. I think that's what frustrates me, is we're suddenly blaming, because that's what politics does, these public health experts who we desperately need more than ever. Because the nuances of what to do, are we going to shut down communities and maybe have another lockdown on the basis of community spread, or are we going to do it on the basis of how many people are actually sick in hospital and dying? I mean, all these are really complex, nuanced public health decisions. And to tell 5,500 public health experts that their jobs are at risk and we don't know how long they're going to last in the middle of a pandemic is not great for their public health and not great for our response. So I think it's a panic measure more than anything.
One final question. What, to you, would a more sensible public health agency look like?
It's difficult. I think there needs to be regional and frontline presences that's part of the same system. We used to have strategic health authorities, and they probably would have managed this better, although they were sometimes seen as the bully boys for the Department of Health. So there was quite a lot of top-down control under Labour. but I think regional public health offices. I would like public health boards in every region, because what you need is local experts on the ground who don't just do infection control, but they understand the culture of the place that they're working in. They know where the factories and the schools are and the problem areas and the deprived areas. They would know precisely where things are likely to cause more of an issue. We know, for example, that COVID has been twice as fatal in poorer areas. Well, your public health experts on the ground would have known that and get in there and support these people sooner. So the bottom line is you need to have a really good public health service on the ground. And I said at the time I didn't think it was a good idea to outsource everything to local authorities. It makes some sense, but local authorities and the NHS generally don't work brilliantly together. So you need them all under one system. You've either got to decide we're going to do this through local authorities or we're going to do it through the NHS, but it needs to be one coordinated system. But not least for the problem that I mentioned earlier, that it's very hard sharing data between different systems because of data protection acts. So we say they're not sharing the data with us, but the law doesn't allow you to do it often.
Yeah. Although one thing actually we covered on the last episode of this podcast was that local testing and tracing has been much more successful than the outsourced one, which again is part of what you're saying about operating on the ground in local communities rather than the
top-down
approach.
In Darwin and Blackburn. They got 90% contact coverage within a week, which is better than anything that Test and Trace have done, just by, you know, you do it by knocking on people's doors and figuring out where the outbreak is, whereas having a big centralized drive miles, get your swab done, doesn't do the contact tracing nearly as well. And that's the bit of the jigsaw that we've not been so good at. And we're going to need to get better at if a second wave comes. We may be lucky. It may be that the virus is becoming less virulent and we don't get hit with a big second wave. But if we do, to prevent lockdown, you've got to get on it early and locally.
Phil Hammond. Next up, BBC News. The BBC has recently decided to axe a long-running strand of programmes called Inside Out. And this decision kind of gets to the heart of a lot of the chaos that's been going on as the BBC reorganises itself yet again. Adam McQueen and Tim Minogue from Private Eye have both been covering this story in various different ways, and I spoke to both of them about it. Here's Tim, first of all, explaining what Inside Out actually is, or rather, was.
Inside Out is the most watched, or it was the most watched, current affairs programme on BBC One. In their series in the spring, they got collective audiences of about an average of 2.5 million and sometimes 3 million. Tony Hall praised this as being a huge achievement. So naturally, they're going to cut it. So they're going to get rid of it. It's a strand or a series of investigative programmes which are done regionally. And until now, they've had 11 regional centres in places like Newcastle, Norwich, Plymouth, the Midlands, London, etc. And these 11 regional centres are going to be reduced to 6. And they have done some terrific stories. It's proper investigative journalism. They spend time on things. In the last couple of years, London did a long investigation about how ISIS had recruited and encouraged people to commit terrorist attacks like Westminster and London Bridge, and how they'd used social media to do that. In the East Midlands, they did a two-year investigation which ended up exposing what they called Victorian working practices and conditions at the HQ of Sports Direct in Derbyshire at Shirebrook, and Mike Ashley was summoned before a committee of the House of Commons as a result of all that, and he promised to make everything better. A Bristol unit, they did a similar investigative thing about conditions at an Amazon warehouse and how Amazon drivers were treated. People were under the cosh so much that they alleged they had to poo in bags and they weren't allowed breaks. The drivers had to do 200 deliveries a day, things like that.
Okay.
Leeds, do you want any more? Do you want some more?
I think the pooing in bags is certainly a good one to to focus the mind on what these guys were investigating. So it's a very successful strand and it's split across the country. Why the decision to axe it?
They just want to save a few quid, really.
Okay.
And they have promised a new programme, but with the reduction of the 11 regions and centres to 6, you're going to have absurdities like 21 of the most senior experienced journalists at these regional centres are almost certainly going to be made redundant, and they're going to be replaced by 3 what they call executive producers in Birmingham, and they're still saying they're going to do 120 investigations in a year. If that sounds impossible,
yeah,
it depends what you mean by investigation. So, you know, are they going to do those long detailed undercover things that I've been talking about, or are they going to do much quicker, shallower items? And that is what my contacts there fear they are going to do.
How much money are they going to save by doing this?
Well, it's quite interesting. They haven't got a title or a budget or a timescale for the new programme, and it's not clear exactly how much they're going to save. But there was a very funny online link up with the staff a few weeks ago, and it was proposed that if the BBC wanted to make money, senior managers might accept a salary cap of $150,000 a year. And one very senior manager who is on $175,000 a year said that this was absurd and it really wasn't worth it because it would only save £5 million a year, which is quite apt because £5 million a year is the cost of Inside Out.
Okay, so yeah, question of priorities there. So that's the story of Inside Out. Now, there's another story in this current issue of the magazine, which is about the BBC making cuts and regional cuts in particular. And here's where I want to bring Adam in, Adam McQueen. Adam, can you tell us a bit about this story?
Yeah, so in the usual way of BBC things, you know, one part of the organisation is pulling in one direction and one is going in the other. So this is specifically about BBC Online, the website. Last week we had Fran Answorth, the head of BBC News, talking about how, you know, at some point in the not too distant future we're going to lose TV bulletins. There's going to be no more news at 6, news at 10 anymore, and it's going to be much more of a digital offering and all online. But what's being done is big cuts. I mean, it's big cuts across the board, but the cuts to BBC Online specifically involve getting rid of what is called the central team, which is a team of sub-editors. So these are the people who hack together the stuff that comes in from journalists out in the field, turn it into coherent news stories, check all the details on it, do the kind of legal checks, and make sure that everything's kind of spelt correctly as well as kind of more fundamental things, and get the stuff up onto the website. And actually, this is outside London, the only part of the BBC website, BBC News website, I should say, which was staffed 24/7. So they were the ones that were kind of there to be called on if any big stories broke overnight. Now, that does seem to be something that the BBC management, who announced that they were getting rid of them, weren't aware of. The original stuff that went round to them was saying that they appeared to be completely unaware that they actually did staff things overnight. But, you know, you get rid of that.
Okay.
I mean, it's not as if any big news stories ever break overnight. I mean, you think of things like the Grenfell Tower fire or the Manchester Arena bombing or the terror attack on Borough Market a few years ago. That shouldn't cause any problems there. But what is being done is that that team is being abolished in Birmingham, and stuff is at that point being moved out into the region, so into the TV and radio operations in the region. So the TV newsrooms who produce your Points West, your Look North, your South Today, all those kind of programmes. Also, within a couple of weeks of announcing that all this stuff was going to go out to the local newsrooms, lo and behold, South Today found themselves up in the dock in front of a very cross judge because they'd managed in 2 of their bulletins, the 6:30 and the 10:30 bulletin, to name a 15-year-old and a 17-year-old who were up on a murder charge in court, which is just a sort of extraordinary thing to do. I mean, you don't have to have a great deal of experience in journalism to know that in almost all cases, under 18s remain anonymous throughout any of the stages of criminal trials. So not only the boss of BBC South, but several other more senior executives were hauled in court in front of the judge to apologise profusely for that. So it's not great timing, really, in terms of these changes they're trying to make.
And there's a kind of weird synchronicity between these two stories. As Tim pointed out just before we started recording, Tim's story this week is about people being sacked around the country and people in Birmingham taking over their responsibilities. And here we've got people in Birmingham at the central unit being sacked and people around the country taking on their responsibilities. So it kind of feels unclear what benefits we're getting out of this.
Well, one clue might be that it's the regional people who are getting the boot on the inside-out teams or the more experienced journalists on the higher grades. And you've got, I think there could be up to 48 people will lose their jobs if you include about a dozen freelancers altogether. And 21 of the most senior people on the higher grades in these regional centres, such as Newcastle and Norwich and so forth, have been told that they're at risk of going. And they're going to be somehow replaced by three people on higher grades in Birmingham. But if you contrast that with Adams, and of course Inside Out is a different thing from the online news and basic regional bulletins, but you're getting some senior people in Birmingham are going to be axed, and their work is going to be done by presumably people who are paid less out in the region. So I think both of those things, the BBC are looking for a cost saving there. I think that's what's driving it.
I think one thing you have to remember with anything that comes from the BBC is that they're very, very good at talking the talk about regionalisation and decentralisation things, but almost everything that happens, certainly within the news department, is about empire building by certain executives and about who has direct management over people. And so there's a very similar thing to this going on at a national level at the moment, which is that radio programmes, so programmes like Today and The World at One and PM, have always had their own designated reporters who have gone out and done those kind of long-form investigative stuff. The stuff that's not in the news bulletins. It makes it into the news bulletins when the stories break. But the kind of more long-form investigations, they are all being got rid of as well. There's been a long, long desire within radio news to get rid of specialist reporters and centralise everything into the power of the newsroom. And that's usually the kind of thing that goes on. It's usually a sort of internal empire building that motivates an awful lot of these things, I think.
The BBC are very good at dressing up, dumbing down changes as something new and exciting. And Declan Wilson, who's the head of TV and online news for BBC England, recently told Stuff that they were facing an unprecedented financial crisis and they had to make savings of £25 million quickly. Now, as we've already addressed, how those savings are going to be made are through job cuts with fewer reporters and sub-editors and presenters and so forth. But dressing it up for the 6:30 news and current affairs slot, Mr. Wilson said the BBC's big idea was to embrace modern, relevant and creative storytelling using audience-focused journalism, greater use of audience data and social listening, answering their questions. We want to be more led by the audience, answering their questions and openly asking them for their stories. We don't want to rely on traditional storytelling techniques all the time. Now, what I think that means is we're not going to have so many proper stories done by proper journalists, and we're going to get our ideas from Twitter and Facebook. So we're going to appeal to youth, you know, which is the holy grail. And as one BBC journalist told me, given that those 6:30 regional programmes currently have big audiences who are middle-aged and upwards, this is high risk. They're going to alienate those people, and they're not going to attract the kids.
And again, another example of the opposite thing going on elsewhere in the same department. One of the hubs that's being set up within the National Newsroom is called the Original Stories Unit, which in itself, if you stop to think about it, is quite an extraordinary concept that not all your journalists are looking for original stories, only some of them. I mean, it's a bit like the concept of an investigative journalist, isn't it? As opposed to all the other ones who just don't bother to ask any questions or think about anything. But this is the Original Stories Unit, which is being headed up by Jonathan Munro, who we talked a bit earlier about that empire building. He's the man who's very much jockeying to be the next head of BBC News when Fran Unsworth is on her way out, and he sees this Original Stories Unit as being very much his tool to take him to the top. top.
National journalists on programmes like Today, World at One, things like this, I would guess are not especially happy about being taken off the shows that they work for. They know different shows have different styles.
Well, one person who's particularly unlikely to be happy about it is the new Today programme editor, Owenna Griffiths, who was given the job of editor of the Today programme and then told within days that she wasn't going to have a single reporter of her own to work on the programme. It's an extraordinary thing to do when you think that the Today programme, as just one example, has such a character of its own and is such a sort of quintessential BBC thing. To take away from that and turn it into just a sort of vehicle for the rolling news service with stories being supplied from elsewhere in the corporation seems like a bizarre move.
Roundup of the papers, glorified roundup of the dailies.
Yeah.
Well, this is all very cheering, guys. Is there any positive notes to end on? There don't seem to be. Right, I think we'll leave it at that. Thanks very much, Tim Minogue and Adam McQueen.
We should do an And Finally item, shouldn't we, as a skateboarding duck or something like that. Used to do on Nationwide.
Adam McQueen and Tim Minogue there. And finally, we do actually have an And Finally this week. It's not about a skateboarding duck. It's about Private Eye magazine. Coronavirus has obviously hugely impacted the entire news industry, and Private Eye has been no exception to that. So I thought I'd speak to Ian Heslop, the magazine's editor, about producing a magazine in lockdown. We have tried to keep the smug, triumphalist, Pravda-like tone of voice out of our conversation. You'll be able to judge if we succeeded. Here is Ian on the latest figures for the magazine.
We are selling 231,073 copies on average. That's our ABC figure, and that is 1% down on last year. So in the middle of the pandemic, we are selling more or less exactly the same number of copies that we were selling before, which is absolutely extraordinary.
My first reaction on hearing the figures, I have to say, was, that's a bit weird, isn't it? So many people buy at newsstands, and newsstands have largely been closed.
Yes, my initial reaction was one of disbelief, and I think that's just conditioned by too many official figures, which you then find aren't true at all, and are revised downwards or upwards or sideways. But, I mean, this one is true, and I think the trajectory is fairly remarkable. They announce lockdown. We have to close the office. I start thinking, we're a magazine. We tend to sell in shops. They're not going to be open anymore. And then the realisation that we have a huge subscriber base, and the Royal Mail has delivered right the way through the pandemic, and that people change their habits. There was no Smith's travel. There were no airports. There were no railways. There were no underground. I thought, you know, this is terrible. We've had it. But the fantastically reassuring thing is that there was a huge increase in subscribers and a huge increase in people saying, I will buy it in other places I go. And people who want to get Private Eye started buying it in supermarkets. I mean, there was no sign of panic buying, which would have been really flattering. And what delights me is that we didn't furlough anyone. We didn't take any money from the taxpayer. We haven't taken the money and kept on working, which I gather applies, according to some survey, by about 50% of firms. And nor have we laid off half the staff or closed the paper down, which is the other thing that's happened, pretty widespread across the industry. So entirely, I think, due to the fact that the readers still want to go on reading this thing, we are still there.
One of the things that affected, for example, I mean, this is a slightly botched analogy, but for example, the food industry had to undergo this big shift where restaurants were closed, and actually, you know, whatever it was, a quarter of meals were eaten in restaurants, and that meant that you couldn't get hold of various things, or that food suppliers, which were built to supply only to restaurants, had to suddenly about face and start selling directly to customers. Is there a similar kind of thing with selling the magazine to different places? As in, what is it a wrench to go from, well, we're sending all of these to newsstands and to, you know, shops at railway stations and Smiths or whatever, to suddenly about face and say, well, this is where we think people might try and get the magazine, so we'll try and sell it in there?
I think the analogy is right. It's essentially everything changed. So then you have to decide, well, where can we sell this thing? I mean, the fishermen who found that people still want fish, they're not going out to restaurants, so you can sell it to their home or you can sell it online to their home. I think the important thing was a set of decisions made fairly early on. I mean, obviously, you know, everything was very, very quick. I decided I wouldn't cut the content. I wouldn't make the paper thinner. And if anything, I would increase it. So there are two areas where we've increased. I mean, coverage of the pandemic itself, where we've been very fortunate in having Phil Hammond, who's our MD, writing every week. But also, yes, it's pretty miserable, but here's some more cartoons. Because my guess was that if we need relief any time, it's now. And there is actually a lot more current coverage. And you could say, cynically, that's because you haven't got any adverts.
I think that's just because you haven't got any adverts, isn't it?
That may well be true. I mean, not any is pushing it. We have some. Really, as you know, if there are any advertisers listening, we're still selling the same number of copies. Again, as a traditional model, if you depend on advertising in order to fill up the pages, you're in real trouble. Just shows you how much I've learned in this period. We have pivoted, Andy, in an extraordinary way to make sure that people still want some old jokes.
Oh, really? Gosh, those came in handy again, did they? That's good. I mean, the magazine's been covering things like, for example, the Metro and the Evening Standard, which, because they don't charge, they're solely dependent on advertising. And if advertising stops, then their business model is in big trouble. Yeah. And I think most readers of magazines and papers don't really twig that those are the two feet. And they're both equally important for a lot of papers and magazines, that advertising is just as important as sales.
Yes, I mean, and you know, there are three ways to make money. You get subscribers, you sell on the newsstands, or you get adverts. Or the fourth way, which traditionally in the media is you have a very, very, very rich owner. And one of the things that surprised me during this is they're no bloody use, these very rich owners. And the slightest whiff that they're not going to make any money anymore, they close you down and sack everyone. If there's any point in having an oligarch billionaire owning your publication, surely it's that they put their hand in their own pocket during the bad times. But no, most of them either threw their hands up or held them out to the government. It was pretty shocking. Whereas, you know, boring old papers that don't have Lord Gnome for real, you know, we had to actually make do and get on and sell the thing.
It feels like you've got some names in mind there, but I can't quite see who you're getting at.
I could really do with a big writ in the middle of this. That would be great.
There's one other thing I've read, and I'm really only asking out of idle curiosity, but one thing I've read is that the pandemic has accelerated a lot of existing trends in print media. So, for example, the trend towards going digital. And I just thought I'd inquire how Private Eye's getting on in terms of the digital-first operation that I know has always been your secret desire.
Yes. Well, digital is still exactly where it was before. What we've done is use the technology. I mean, I can't believe, you know, the production staff and people on kitchen tables have done in order to make the eye appear. And, I mean, I don't think you can tell the difference. They are extraordinary. What is absolutely apparent is that when everyone's living a life on screen and spending all day on screen or all day reading on screens, the pleasure of getting a magazine, getting a real physical thing in your hand that you can go in the garden and read, or you don't have to be sitting on a train if you're not going on a train anymore. But wherever you're doing it, people's pleasure is amazing. And I know people have got a lot of time to write, but people do write. You know, the letters pages in the Eye are now overwhelmed with people. That also applies to contributors and cartoonists. It's not that there's no material out there. You know, there's a lot of people sitting around thinking, I know what I want to say. So we've had the benefit of a huge amount of material sent in, but it's not the digital experience people want. You know, they send me photographs of themselves in their gardens, or now they're in the pub with a pint on it. They just say, this is what I like.
Okay, so we'll put the digital revolution just on hold. Can I make a note of that? There have been various reports of news fatigue, which has understandably sunk in after, you know, nearly 6 months now of headlines about exactly the same thing. Has there been evidence of that at the Eye in particular or not?
I don't think there has. And every time I think, well, the readers are going to be sick of this, or they'll be desperate not to read this, I'm proved wrong, largely when I've decided that I'm going to do it anyway. I mean, the greatest criticism was during the Cummings period, when people were just saying, you've become obsessed. Why are you going on about Cummings all the time? And then I put him on the cover. And in fact, most of that issue was almost entirely devoted to Mr. Cummings. But that is our highest selling issue this year. That sold nearly 240,000 copies, which suggests that most of our readers did not want to move on. They didn't want to forget about it. They didn't want to stop being pathetic and talking about things that don't matter. They think it does matter. He's still there. And I think that approach was vindicated. I think what readers want is they want to be told what's happening in terms of the virus and the crisis. And they also want to be told that you haven't taken your eye off everything else that's going on. So all our regular columns are still there. There's still stuff happening, often below the radar, which we're still covering. So it's not a brief. You're not getting a holiday from the news, but you're just getting a reminder that the rest of the news is still going on.
Ian Hislop there. My thanks to him and to our other contributors this week, Tim Minogue, Adam McQueen and Phil Hammond. That's it for this edition of Page 94. We will be back again next month with another one. And until then, the magazine remains available on whatever newsstands near you, but, as we may have mentioned, for very reasonable subscription rates. You can find details of that at private-i.co.uk. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. Goodbye.